So welcome once again to another talk. There may be some still coming in, but the hardcore are here already. So you guys. Another talk another day. And I do respect the questions which come up in the evening. And there was one question which somebody asked and I just pushed it aside for a couple of days until I could address it at one of the talks. That's, you know, what does right view mean? And it also would include just the talk on insight, simply because insight has been so exaggerated that there's a whole meditation tradition just called insight meditation, and as if whatever other meditation you do does not include insight. And as I've mentioned already, insight and calm, vipassana, samatha, they all go together. There is no separation. It's not you do one first and then you do the other. It's not that one is better than the other. That is just conceit again. These are both always integral to the practice of meditation. When you let go, the mind becomes peaceful and you see things as they truly are. That's one of my favorite sayings of the Buddha. You don't need to quote it, which sutta, because it occurs 100 times. From the stillness, you see things as they truly are. Through stillness, you get insight. And the other one was that, I gave that simile, I just repeat it to many people in interviews, and also I did mention it the first day, the simile of the mountain lake. Well, even if you go and see our little pond down there, if there's any waves on the surface, you cannot get a clear image in that lake. Everything is distorted. But when that lake is perfectly still, when there's not even a ripple on it, when the ducks are on holiday or they're meditating somewhere in the bush and leaving the lake alone, then there's no even ripple on the surface. It's perfectly smooth. And then you get an accurate reflection of the truth and beauty which surrounds it. So it's always that stillness and insight go together. Now the trouble is, being Westerners, we love insight. Well, actually, we're not really insight. A lot of time, it's not insight, it's thinking. And a lot of times, right view is just thinking and philosophizing and arguing over the 12 links of dependent origination, the nature of emptiness, what happens when a person gets enlightened, do they live again afterwards, or what happens to them. And you know, a lot of that is a total waste of time, but it's good fun. We love thinking and speculating and trying to work it all out. But does it really get you anywhere? All it does is get you to argue with your friends who's right and who's wrong. And it's just insight born of thinking. The problem is with right view, for a lot of times, it's not right view, it's just right opinion. And you know, when people are opinionated, they get into big trouble. So I gave a little indication when I answered that question. It may not have been what you expected, which is great. When you give a talk, don't tell people what they expect to hear. Otherwise, it's a waste of time listening. You want to see or hear something which challenges you, which takes you deeper. So when I talked about right view, I said, it is that view which creates peace and harmony. I didn't say what the view is. I said, no, you know it by its effect. And if you can understand that right view is what creates peace and harmony and stillness and freedom, then you've got a good understanding of what is wrong view and wrong insight. How many times does people's views and insights create lots and lots of arguments? Which is the best form of Buddhism? Is it Theravada? Is it Mahayana? Is it Tibetan? Or is it Hahayana? Who's got the best? Even when you try and unite things, all you do is actually get another religion. So that's a problem. So, which is the right one? And of course, whatever one creates peace and harmony, that's the right one. It doesn't depend on which one it is, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana. It depends on how you practice it. In the same way, it doesn't matter what meditation object you're looking at. It's how you're looking at it. That is the most important. So don't go around saying, I am a follower of the great Ajahn Brahm. And someone else says, no, I'm a follower of the great Ajahn Mahabua. And you have a fight. Then you're not following anybody. Because you're following stupidity. So don't do that. If it's right view, if it's seeing clearly, it always creates peace and freedom and harmony and stillness. That's why you know it's right view. So, how do you learn exactly what that right view is? You sit down and see what happens. What you do, your ideas, your view, does that create peace and harmony? Or does it create more anxiety and more anger? How do you view the person who continues to bang the door in your cottage? Do you view them in such a way it creates peace and harmony and freedom? Or do you view them in a way, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm about that person. I'm going to get them blacklisted. I'm going to tell Danny they will never be allowed to go on a retreat ever again. Now what does that create inside of you? That creates a lot of tension, a lot of stress. That must be wrong view. So you know what right view is by how, what it does to you. And you can test this out throughout the whole of your meditation. What creates peace in your mind? What creates this beautiful sense of harmony? And harmony is another word for peace. I mean, you're at ease with people, you're at ease with the weather, you're at ease with your stupid mind, you're at ease with... You know, you can't get harmony in this world by converting everybody to being a Buddhist. Even if they were a Buddhist, I'd have to convert everybody to believing in Ajahn Brahm before there was harmony. And even I argue with myself sometimes, so still there's no harmony left. How can you ever get harmony by trying to make everybody the same? You don't get harmony by trying to control the world and make people think just the way you think and act just the way that you think they should act. You don't get harmony and peace in this world by telling everybody, forcing them to never cough in a meditation retreat, never to make any noise, never to do anything stupid. You can't do that. The only way you can create harmony is to realize that the war which goes on inside of you is the war between the way things are and the way you want them to be. That's the war. The way things actually are right now and what you want them to be. And how do you settle that war and bring peace? Wrong view is I'm going to change the way things are to be what they should be. I'm going to get every meditator I've been teaching so hard, working so hard. And how many of you got jhanas yet? Oh my God, it's so depressing teaching retreats. Now that's making war, trying to change you. So instead of trying to change you and change the world, I love you for who you are. In other words, instead of trying to change the world to fit the way it should be, I change the way I think it should be to fit the way the world is. So everyone here, you should be exactly as you are. No different, no better, no worse. And when my view is you should be exactly as you are, no better. I have no expectations of you at all. A long time ago I gave up having all expectations. When I do that, then I'm at peace, I'm at harmony. I accept you for as you are, I accept jhana growth the way it is, I accept the food the way it is. When you accept things like that, what does it bring you? Peace and harmony and freedom. There must be something called right view there. So this is actually where you are developing your insights, not through thinking and theory and working it all out by logic or inference, but by direct experience. What view works? What attitude creates peace and freedom in your mind? Look at your body. How do you get a peaceful, harmonious, happy body? Not by trying to make it something different than it is. Even if I did do exercises every morning and tortured myself, I would still be fat. It's just who I am. I'm very happy. People should keep on saying, you should watch your weight. I do watch it. I watch it go up, 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 up. What's the problem? So you can understand, this is how you become peaceful and happy and free of all these things. So you can see what is insight or what actually works. So the whole idea of meditation, whether it's walking meditation or sitting meditation, is like a laboratory experiment to try and find out what right view is. What actually calms you down? What creates peace in your mind? And you find out that you've done this enough now. Every time you control, every time you try and make things happen, you create suffering. That's one of the first things I taught the first evening. Remember the two types of meditation? The first type of meditation is wanting leads to suffering. You should have known that by now. You've wanted a lot over the last 5 or 6 days. You haven't got what you want. So you suffered endlessly. Why don't you just give up and have absolutely no hope of getting anything on this whole retreat? No hope of getting nimittas, no hope of getting beautiful breath, no hope of even sitting longer than half an hour. Give up all hope. Then you'll be so peaceful and so free. You'll be happy as anybody. You'd also probably get peace as well. So a lot of times when we do that second noble truth, wanting leads to suffering, wanting leads to suffering, at least we know just the law of nature. The Buddha said when you're separated from what you like, what you want, that's called a suffering. And it also gives you a lot of stress. You have to work hard, strive, figure out how to achieve your goals in life. And you've always noticed whenever you reach one goal, there's always another one afterwards. This is what a problem. I mentioned this in one of my books. It's one of the insights I got even when I was at college. It's one of the insights which helped me be a Buddhist monk. And that was the education system in UK at that time. At the age of 15 or 16, I did it at 14, we did O-levels. And that was the time I loved going out with my friends playing soccer in the streets or in the local park. Now, I loved playing soccer. But what happened was that my teachers and my parents, they told me, listen, instead of wasting your time playing soccer, I should have played soccer, I could have been a rich person. You know how much these soccer stars earn these days? They're millionaires. I was deprived. But anyway, they said, no, go to school and study. You know, do your homework, do extra work, because if you do well at your O-levels and get good grades, then you'll do well in life. And of course, being young, you believed everybody. So I worked hard, I gave up playing soccer, and I just studied hard, and I got very good results. You know what happens when you pass one exam? You have another one to do in a couple of years. So A-levels. But this was really important. By this time, I wasn't chasing a ball anymore. I was chasing girls. And my parents, or my father, who died shortly afterwards. I know he's still alive most of the time before I was doing A-levels. My parents and teachers said, A-levels are really important. More important than the O-levels. If you pass the A-levels and you do really well, you can go to university. And then you're made for life. So I gave up chasing girls, and I stayed at home and did my homework, and I did really well. So well, you went to a big university, Cambridge. And they said, wow, this is really good. Work hard at Cambridge. Forget the parties. Don't socialize, because if you get a good degree from Cambridge, you are made forever. And so that's what I started doing that, not for too long, by the way, because when I was at Cambridge, that's when you were intelligent enough to start to think. And I actually became suspicious of all this. Because I knew some friends who'd already completed university. And were they set? Were they happy? No, of course not. As soon as they finished university, they got their first job. They were saving up for a car. They were saving up for this. and they're working really, really hard. Were they happy? No, not at all. They were working their butts off. And I see people older. You know, they find their partner in life. When I find my partner in life, when I find the one who is meant for me, then I'll be happy ever after. You've been there and done that, haven't you? Some of you older ones. Because once you get married, that's really hard work, marriage. Then you've got to work extra jobs, and then you need a house, you need a place to stay, and that's really expensive. So you manage to borrow some money from your parents or whatever in the bank, and you get your mortgage, and you have to work really, really hard to pay off the mortgage. The trouble is, what comes next? Babies. Then you really are stuffed. 20 years, you've got to pay so much. But what I saw some of the elder friends, you know, they had kids, and our kids are doing well at school another few years, and then we'll be free of the kids. They think, when the kids leave, then I'll be happy. They're still not happy. And then when the kids leave, that's when they get close to, you know, they start thinking about retirement. Because what they think then is, okay, we'll really work hard, and then we retire, then we'll be happy. They're still putting off their happiness. And the next thing I noticed, this was in UK in the 60s and 70s, I saw that when they did retire, were they happy? No, I found out that they were all going to churches and temples when they were old. If you ever go to a church, it's mostly filled with old people. You know why? Because they all think, when I die, then I'll be happy. They never are happy. It's when I get this, when I get to heaven. And just like you, when I get jhana, then I'll be happy. Stop it. That is ridiculous. That is spiritual materialism again. When I get something, then I'll be happy. And the Buddha said, look, that by itself is suffering. Now, separated from where you want to be. So a long time ago, I figured out, look, the only way to be happy is not to be happy somewhere else, to be happy here. Instead of thinking, when I get this, I'll be happy, I think, when I've got what I have already, then I'm happy. Because I often promise myself, I promise myself, when I built Jhana Grove, then I'll be happy. And I built it now, so I'm happy. So can you understand what insight is? It creates this beautiful sense of peace and happiness. You are uncovering the second factor of the Four Noble Truths, and the third factor as well. When you're suffering, when you're content, you let go of craving, that's called Nibbana, the end of suffering, happiness. What do you need to do to get enlightened? Do you have to get the jhanas and get insight and get all these brilliant lights and fly through the air and go, bah, I see the truth now. You can taste enlightenment by letting go of craving, not wanting anything. I'm so happy just being here right now in this old body, in this old retreat center, listening to this old monk saying the same old stories again. Are you happy? If you want it to be different, you are suffering. If you are content where you are, you are happy. It's all up to you. Nothing to do with Jhana Grove, nothing to do with me, nothing to do with the weather, everything to do with your attitude. When you get the point, you get the taste of enlightenment. I'm happy to be here. Craving has stopped for a little while. I'm just content. Now you understand why I've been hammering on at letting go, being in the present moment, letting go of all wanting, stop controlling, just being kind to this moment, just being aware and being kind, letting things be. This is insight practice. You don't think it is, but my goodness, it is. You are understanding the Four Noble Truths. Direct experience, not thinking about it, not writing a dissertation and a paper to get a PhD in suffering. They're all PhDs in suffering. That's all universities teach, suffering studies. But the Department of Suffering. Department of Medicine and Suffering, Department of Philosophy and Suffering, the Department of Chemistry and Suffering. It's all suffering departments in universities. But
this is actually where we understand for ourselves. We do this little experiment. In this retreat you've had, when have you really been happy? When have you actually had this moment you feel just so blissful, so peaceful, so at ease? That's a taste of freedom. This is where you get your insight from. Ah, now I understand how to meditate, how to be still, how to be free. It's all teaching you all the time. But a lot of times we miss it. We always think enlightenment is somewhere in the distance. An old Zen story. There was a stupid man, and he needed to light the fire to cook his rice. So he was looking for the fire with a candle. Where's fire? I want fire. I need something to light my rice. So he's looking for the box of matches with a lit candle. If he'd only known what fire was, he could have cooked his rice much earlier. So you're looking for an enlightenment with an enlightened mind. Where is enlightenment? Look, always looking in the wrong place. That's the trouble. So we learn how to let go, make peace, and it feels. This is actually something which creates peace and harmony. Right now we can feel it, it's tangible, it's not just some theory, it's not something you argue with, it's something which is real, it's here. And you can touch it, you can taste it, it's right in front of you. And that's only the taste. Of course, later on you go for the full meal. You don't want just a taste of breakfast. How many just tasted breakfast? The toast tastes nice and then you left it. No, you ate the whole, sometimes a whole loaf of bread. Because you really want to sort of really get into it. So later on you go into deeper insights. What actually is this stillness? And the next thing you do is, yeah, you know this is freedom. Why is it so hard to be still and to be peaceful? You know the cause of suffering, it's just wanting things. But why is it I can't stop wanting? Why is it, it seems so easy just to let go, for goodness sake. Why is it so hard to do? And that's actually where the insight which is given you from fear comes in. Right, sometimes people say, oh, I'm afraid, can you please teach me how not to be afraid in meditation? Actually, I like that fear. Because that fear is a cold face of insight. You get huge insights when you look at that fear and think, what am I afraid of? Why am I afraid? What is the problem here? Because you know this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be peaceful. You're going to get blissed out. You know that this is going to happen. You have enough confidence that I know what I'm talking about. But then you get this barrier of fear. Why can't I let go? Where does this fear come from? And that is where you start to know that all fear is about to let go of an attachment. Something you really cherish. And I don't mean just cherish in the sense of it's that I like this. Cherish in the sense that you think this is an essential part of your being. This is who you are. You're letting go, step by step, of yourself. Who you assume you are. That is why when people's body disappears. I remember this one Singapore gentleman. He came to me. He was so agitated. I thought he'd seen some sort of ghost or he'd had a psychotic episode or something. I said, what the heck has happened to you? You look so scared. He said, yes, I was meditating and my hands disappeared. Ah! Oh, is that all? But that was the first time he wasn't in control of his own body. That part of his body moved out of his command. And that scared the hell out of him. Now, why does this happen? It's because we are, whatever we possess, we always like to control. This is our problem. Yes, you realize, except for Daddy, you don't control jhana growth. So because of that, we think we control jhana. That's why we want to make sure it's all okay, it's all tidy, it's this way and that way. But you don't control jhana growth, so you can just enjoy the place. Whatever you own, you tend to control. Did I tell that story the other day about visitor and owner? Yeah. Okay. You're all nodding your head. Some of you are anyway. Those of you who are still alive. But that's a very nice little simile about if you're an owner of a place, you always have to control it, look after it, manage it, make sure it's okay. But if you're a visitor, you're so free. That's why it's so great to come to Jhana Grove. It's not your home. It's this beautiful place, and you know, you leave, and even if you trash your room, actually please don't trash your room. It's not quite the same as trashing your own house. If you trash your own house, you have to fix it. So if you're a visitor, you can enjoy the place. It's free, it's beautiful. But as I say, if you're an owner, you can actually see all the faults, all the things which need to be fixed, and you tend to control things. This is what's happening. When you have fear, it's like you're losing ownership. You're losing ownership of your body. Losing ownership of your mind when you stop controlling it. And that is the scariest thing of all. But using the simile of the visitor and owner, when you are a visitor, it's much more fun. So be a visitor to your body. Not my body. Thank goodness, that's why I don't worry about being fat. It's not my body. It's just, oh, I'll just hand it in later on, get another one, a better model. That's what you do, isn't it? I don't know why people like to sort of keep on living and living and living when they get very old. You wouldn't treat an old car that way, would you? When your old car is really done, it's just really hard to get on the road. You're always having to fix it up at the mechanic. Like people have to keep going to the doctor once a week to get it fixed up. You need all these supplements to keep yourself going. You know, you rattle when you go along the road. You know, that's the old people and myself and the car. Why don't you trade in the car and get a new model? It's absolutely crazy. But no, because it's my body. I'm attached to it. This is one of the problems, the attachment, the possession. So after a while, you realize in meditation, it's not your body at all. It doesn't belong to you. My body does what it wants. I've got an itchy nose again. I don't know why. Nose, don't itch, okay? I can tell it that. Will it listen to me? Absolutely not. My body is totally out of control. It's a heretic. It does what it wants to do, not what I want to do. Can you control your body? Does it really belong to you? Sometimes you get sick at the most inconvenient times. I remember once in Kuala Lumpur, I was giving a talk and I felt really sick. And I was trying to hold it back because people came from a long way to listen to my talk. And they were really listening, and then I said I had to go to the toilet, but I never made it. I threw up on the stage. I can't control my body. That's just what it does when it's sick. That's actually very good. I got a lot of sympathy for that. You don't usually get much sympathy, but I got a lot of sympathy that day. But I'm just saying, your body is totally out of control. You should know that already. So just by sitting meditation, you're learning that. You get an ache here, an ache there. The more you try and control the body, the more tight it gets. And it's more of a problem. Instead, I've been teaching you to be mindful and kind to it, as if it was somebody else's body. Just like a mother loves her only child, we chant in the morning. Now the child isn't part of the mother. It's separate from the mother. Born of the mother, but separate from it. So you love your body as if it's your child. Not your body, but somebody else's body. It's wonderful. If I treat my body as if it's somebody else's, I'm much kinder to it. And I don't try and control it so much. So that's actually a sense of letting go of the body. And also your thoughts. How many of you have tried to control your mental world? Does it really belong to you? If it did, you'd be able to say, shut up, and it would follow orders. How many times have you managed to stop the mind thinking? Okay, I can think now, but now I'm going to meditate, okay? Shut up for now. I need to meditate. Can you do that? You've tried many, many times. You've always failed. Haven't you got the insight yet that your mind doesn't belong to you? It doesn't follow orders. It does what it wants to do. So what can you do then? You just let it go. I let my body go. When it wants to get sick, it gets sick. When it wants to die, it dies. It doesn't follow my schedule. Same with my mind. Mind, whatever you want to do, you do what you want to do. It's not mine. You let it go. Can you do that? No, because it's my mind, it's my thoughts.
is my body. That's one of the problems. That's called attachment. What happens in meditation? All those attachments, those wrong views, thinking this belongs to you, they get challenged. They get challenged fundamentally. Your body is disappearing. And those of you who have managed to get your body to disappear, so, you know, you're sitting there and just in the realm of the mind, you can't feel your body. Oh, it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful when you don't control this body. And you come out afterwards and your body is so healthy and fit. You know, I always, you know, you see me sort of when I talk in the evening at the question time, when I get up afterwards, you're always really stiff. If I give a talk for an hour or 2 hours, you're always very stiff. But if I meditate for a couple of hours and get into deep meditation, or 3 hours or 4 hours, you'd think I'd be paralyzed by the end of 4 hours, sitting absolutely still. No way. If you really get into meditation, it's not a pain in the body at all. Your body feels like a young person, like Usain Bolt. I'm sure if after a few jhanas, I think you could actually hold your own against Usain Bolt in the 100 meters. You feel so fast, whoosh, jhana power. But that's what you feel like. No pain, really fit and healthy. Why is that? Because when you try and control your body, you always make it worse. When you let the body go, it gets much better. I've learned that so much that I realize this body doesn't belong to me. And the best thing to do is to leave it alone, and it looks after itself much better when I'm just busy doing something else. And the same with my mind. I don't control my mind. It doesn't belong to me. This was the second, for those of you who really like deep teachings, now, the first teaching of the Buddha, the first sutra, was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutra, where he taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The second one was the Anattalakkhana Sutra, where he taught non-self. And it's a brilliant sutra, a great teaching on insight. And it starts off by talking about what he called these five khandhas, which we assume to be ourself. You know, the body, the feelings, perceptions, mental formations such as thought, but especially will and consciousness, the six consciousnesses. We all think these things belong to me, that these are ours. But the Buddha said, look, these things don't belong to you. If they did belong to you, you'd be able to say, oh, may my body be like this, may my body be like that. You can't do that. It proves it doesn't belong to you. He said, if your feeling, your happiness and your suffering, if it really belonged to you, if it was really in control, you'll be able to say to yourself, oh, may I only be happy and have no suffering in life. Ha 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 ha. Even the Buddha could do that. You'll be able to say, oh, may my perceptions, may my thoughts, the fourth of the five khandhas, oh, may my thoughts be like this, may they not be like that. The Buddha said, you cannot do that. It's impossible. Even the Buddha said that. You can't control your sankharas, your thoughts, because they don't belong to you. Oh, may my consciousness be like this. May my consciousness be like that. You can't do that. It doesn't belong to you. That's the opening stanzas in one of the great suttas of the Buddha, which created the first five fully enlightened monks. You don't own anything. You can't control things. So what do you do when you realize that? You should have realized that by now. Every time you try to control your mind, oh, may my mind be peaceful. Oh, may it be see the nimittas. Oh, may it be happy. Oh, may it be... Can you succeed? And you think, oh, there must be something wrong. I'm not seeing something. If only Ajahn Vah would tell me, then I can control things. And this was the Buddha saying, it's impossible to control. So what do you do? If you can't control anything, sit here and do nothing. Let go of trying to control. There was a great insight from that sutra. Nothing belongs to you. So why are you trying to control it? That is the myth, the craving. Try to do things. And then you find, okay, I'm just going to let things, I can't control things anyway, I just let things go. And then you find things get really, really peaceful. It's the controlling itself is the problem. It's the wanting it to be like this, wanting it to be like that. It's not what it is. It's not what you experience, whether you're old or young, sick, stupid or whatever. That's not the problem. It's what you want it to be. That is the problem. So that sounds interesting. Maybe you believe it, maybe you don't. But you try that. I'm just going to let my mind be, whatever it wants to do. I'm going to let my body be. I'm going to let everything. I'm not going to control whatsoever. You have to do this 100% with fully mindfulness, because sometimes people try that. So I'm going to let the mind be. And you go thinking all over the place for a couple of hours. You haven't let it go. You've been right in there in the thinking, pushing it along, being interested, being involved. You haven't let go at all. If you really do let it go, I just thought, what the heck? Then it stops. Remember, all thinking, what it really is waves on the surface of your mind. It's got no real meaning at all. Yeah, it sparkles, it looks interesting, but it's got no real meaning. It has nothing to do with the truth. Never imagine that you can think your way to anything which is reasonable and meaningful and truthful. All you're thinking, you should know by now, it gets you into more trouble. It doesn't solve problems, it makes more problems. That's, I think, I was always interested in philosophy, especially at Cambridge. And after I left, about 10 or 20 years later, this great philosopher, he came with this watertight proof that you can't prove anything. That was really weird. He proved that nothing could be proven. And basically that was the end of Western philosophy. Now they argued themselves to an impasse that nothing could be proved. That's through thinking. But when it comes through knowing, through the experience, this is much real than any thoughts. So after a while you just let go of these thoughts. And when you're still, then you see things. That's where insight comes from. That's always been the Buddhist teachings, that wisdom, truth, comes from stillness, not from thinking. So there you go. You know, you just see these thoughts. They're just waves on the surface of the lake. They've got no real meaning. And the only way to get them to be peaceful and to find some meaning is just to leave things alone. Stop interfering with the lake. And the waves, they disappear by themselves. Just friction. And after a while, there's no more waves. And that's what people find. Sometimes they're sitting for days and days, nothing happens. They just give up. And they just sit here, killing time, not expecting anything. In other words, not owning anything. They're a visitor to their body and their mind, not an owner. So you just enjoy it for what it is. Whenever I visit somebody else's house, when you visit somebody else's house, do you do the washing up for them? Do you just vacuum their carpet when you visit someone else's house? Of course not. You're a visitor. You've got no business to be done. So you be a visitor to your own mind. Stop vacuuming up, you know, all of the defilements. Stop tidying up, you know, all of the stupid thoughts. Stop mowing the lawn inside your brain. Leave things alone. It's not yours. You're a visitor. So when you visit, you just sit there, relax, and enjoy. And you know, you also appreciate the beauty much more as a visitor. This is what I said in that a few days ago. Monastery over in Bodhinyana, it's a beautiful monastery when you're not the abbot. If I'm an owner, I see all the faults. If I'm a visitor, I see its beauty. If you're an owner of your mind, you see all its faults. You can't enjoy it. There's so much things to be done. So many defilements, sloth and torpor, restlessness, so many things to get rid of. But if you're a visitor to your mind, that's beautiful. Here's my mind thinking away. It's nothing to do with me. I can really enjoy it and be peaceful. Don't be an owner. Always be a visitor. Then you can let go, which means you don't control the lake anymore. And little by little, the waves disappear and it's perfectly still. This is what right view is, what creates peace, harmony, stillness, freedom. And it really gets very deep. Sometimes you ask, why does a monk not have sex? Why don't they watch movies? Why do they live such a harsh life? You know, you missed all the Harry Potter movies. You miss so much in life. You miss having kids, Ajahn Brahm. That was a close call. You know, the problem is sometimes these days, because unfortunately the Roman Catholic Church and all the priests, you know, creating lots of mischief, a lot of people nowadays, they say celibacy is not natural. I've heard that many, many times. And I try to remind, that's exactly what you used to say about gays. Homosexuality, not natural, we can cure it. That was really offensive. But now they're doing it to the celibates. Celibacy is not natural. Ajahn Brahm, you must have a really hard time inside your brain, not being able to follow your natural urges. It's not always natural. You make your choice in life. You have the freedom. That's who you are. If you're celibate, you're celibate. Celebrate celibacy. That is my sort of motto. Actually, I've actually threatened this a few times. And one day I'm going to do this. I'm not sure that Michael would do this. In the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, where they have all these floats for different sort of causes, I'm going to get a float, celibate rights. I want more recognition and more respect for celibates. But anyway, after a while, you know, when your mind gets very, very peaceful, then your body disappears. When your body, you don't need sex or enjoyment of the body anymore. Because one of the things you realize, it's not the sort of thing you can actually think. These things are a surprise. Insight surprises you. It's not what you imagine. But my God, it's what's true. Your body disappears and you're so free and happy. And that's actually where you realize this body is a pain. You know that sometimes people have these near-death experiences. You know, they die on the operating table. And they go floating out of their body. And you know, they all have a really good time. The classic story, which I really like reading this one. There was an English lady, and she died on the operating table or whatever. And she was floating up out of her body. And it was so wonderful, not having an old body anymore. She was enjoying herself, floating here and floating there, having the time of her death, not the time of her life. And she met this spirit. And the spirit said, I'm sorry, you're not supposed to die yet. You've got to go back. You know, you've heard that tale before. You know, people say it's not your time, so they go back into the body. But this woman, she had attitude. She said, I am not going back. And the spirit said, but you have to. It's not your time yet. I don't care. This is fun. I'm not going to go back to the old, ugly, fat body. No way. And they had an argument in this near-death experience played. She was arguing with the spirit. But you have to. She said, no. You have to. Absolutely not. I am not going. Okay? And apparently, she said, the spirit somehow or other got hold of her and actually threw her back into her body against her will. And so she went back into her body and woke up and she was alive in this really old body. And when she was being interviewed for the BBC, the old documentary I saw, she was so upset. She was so pissed off at that spirit that she said, when I die next time, die for good. I'm going to find that guy. I'm going to beat him up. What he did to me is unforgivable. She meant it. I wouldn't like to be that spirit when she dies. I hope that spirit gets reincarnated by then, because she can't find her. He's going to be a big... But the nice part of that story was just what a wonderful time she was having. And really was enjoyable. Much better than being in the body. We all assume, you want to get back into your body again so you can be alive. Oh, what a great relief. Well done, doctors. You've kept her alive. Was that really good? Should have let her die. She was having a good time. So what that actually tells us, if you really get your head around this, is sometimes this body is really heavy and a great burden. And when you actually die, you're totally free. If you don't believe that, you get into deep meditation now. You know what I mean. The benefit of that means you'll never again be afraid to die. You're being relieved from this heavy body. Oh, great, bring it on. So the doctor said, I'm sorry, you're going to die. You go, yes, at last, I've had enough of this old body. Or like Dr. K.C. Dharmananda, wrote many books. When his doctor told him that he had terminal cancer, really terminal, you know, can't do anything about it, he burst out laughing. Oh, that's my type of monk. You say, terminal cancer, Ajahn Brahm. Yes!
Can you do that? Instead, I'm too young to die. I'm only 80. People are actually crazy.
The thing is, because they don't know, they think this body is great fun. So after a while, you realize, especially meditation, it's lovely when you can let go of the body and be totally free. So when the Buddha said this body is actually suffering, you get some idea what he means. Because in a meditation, there's so much bliss not having a body. But I always like saying, this is where you really stir people up. You go even deeper. There, one of the best jhanas is the second jhana. Because that's the place your will stops. There's no more will left. Choice has vanished. Just like your hands vanish when you start meditating. That's pretty scary. You know, you can't feel your hands anymore. Now you're meditating, there's no will left. You can't do anything. There's nothing. There's no levers anymore. There's no, that thing which you recognize as choice and will is totally vanished. It's disappeared. Oh, what freedom at last. No will has been left. It's totally gone. From that experience, you understand the fourth sankhara, will. Sorry, the fourth kanda, will, the sankhara kanda. The Buddha said that's suffering. To will is to suffer. To do is a pain. Can you understand that? No way. This is crazy teachings. And doing, that's my life. I do things. And doing is fun. I can build monasteries. I can write books. I can do all this sort of stuff. Look how much I've done. Mostly a waste of time. So it is, really. So anyway. So you understand what actually will truly is. Now, I love giving the simile of the driverless bus. It's one of my best similes you invent. Because sometimes you get these similes from the sutras, and sometimes you make your own ones up. And it's great when you make your own ones up, because then you actually expand just the way of teaching the Dhamma in using modern terms. In the time of the Buddha, they'd always talk about chariots and armies and rice fields and stuff like that, which was great in the time of the Buddha, or maybe northeast Thailand. But, you know, no one has ever ridden a chariot in sort of Singapore, or planted a rice field, sort of in Perth. That doesn't really make much sense. So we use like bus journeys, because everyone's been on a bus. And I use a simile that your life is like a bus journey. And sometimes your life goes through really beautiful landscapes, beautiful rolling hills and mountains and waterfalls and babbling little brooks, and it's so beautiful, your life, you're having a wonderful time. And when your bus is going through the beautiful scenery, you ask the bus driver, oh, can you please slow down? I'm enjoying this. Even stop so I can really enjoy the wonderful times of this journey. Now, what does your bus driver do? Puts his foot down on the accelerator and speeds off. That's right, the time in your life, you're having great fun, and it's really nice and enjoyable. It doesn't last that long, does it? No, really, the happy times of your life, they should last longer. And the reason it doesn't last longer is there's a stupid bus driver inside. Always does the wrong things, makes the wrong choices, and so your happiness doesn't last that long. And there's other times in your life, you're really going through the toxic nuclear waste dumps of life. You know, that unhappy experience. You're going through a divorce, a sickness, grief that you lost somebody. It lasts too long. So when you go through the toxic waste dumps, you know, in your bus, you'll tell the bus driver, put your foot down on the accelerator, get out of here quickly. I don't want this suffering. I want it to end now, fast. And what does your bus driver do? Slams on the brakes. And you have to endure the toxic waste dumps of your life longer than you really should. Why is it that suffering lasts longer than it should? And happiness is so short. And you always think it's because you make the wrong choices. You've got a stupid bus driver. So many people, they come to religions, they come to places like Buddhism, because they just want to teach their bus driver to be wise. That's all they need to do, they think.
If I just have wise choices, get all these amazing two bad bricks in the wall, open the door of your heart, make the wise choices for change, then my bus will be able to slow down in the happy times and be able to speed out of the unhappy times. You'll be able to have more happiness and less suffering. And that's what you come to meditate for. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. Because if you're going to train your choice to be wise, compassionate, to do the right thing instead of always making stupid choices and getting into trouble again, you have to find that bus driver's seat. Before you can train the will, you've got to find what this will truly is. To understand what choice is, so then you can make wise choices instead of stupid choices. So that's what happens in meditation. You find the bus driver's seat, the seat of your will. Just like being in the bus, you get fed up with the stupid bus driver, you get up this seat, you go up the aisle, go to the front of the bus to try and teach this stupid bus driver how to drive a bus. And what do you do when you get to the bus driver's seat? Ah, the shock of your life. The bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. This thing you've called will and choice is just a phantom. It's like a ghost. No one is there. It's empty seat. Ah! That's what happens in second jhana. Where is the will? It's nothing there. It's gone. Empty. Nothing. Totally. Not as a thought, as an experience. Now that really sort of turns your head over heels, the way you look at your life. Because you realize the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one driving your bus. That thing you thought was you, your choice, your will, all the decisions you make, you really think that you made those decisions. You all thought that you decided to come on this retreat. You did not. You had no choice but to come. That's why you're here. There's very easy proof. You're here, therefore you had no choice. But it feels like we had a choice. And I demand that I have a choice because I want to be in control. That illusion of wanting to be in control, that craving to be in control, that must to be in control is what creates the illusion. But you find that that's all totally overturned when you get into these deep jhanas. There's nobody there. So you come out afterwards, oh, there's no bus driver in here. There is no Ajahn Brahm. There is no Ajahn Chah. Remember that book? There is no Ajahn Chah. There is no Buddha. There is no me. So now there is no me. I can be totally irresponsible. Don't have to do anything anymore. So what happens? You find there's no one in there. What that means is you go back to your seat on the bus and you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. Happiness, suffering is just part of life. And you don't complain, which means your mental suffering totally vanishes. You said, I don't want to have an itchy nose. I don't want to meditate. I don't want all that whining and wailing which goes on is between your ears. That stops. No more craving. There's nobody to complain to anymore. No more wanting, at peace, free, in harmony. After a time, when you realize this, fantastic. It's all these things which the Buddha said, which you read about, which you might think about and write a PhD thesis on, non-self. Total waste of time until you actually experience these things. When things disappear, the simile, which I'm going to finish off with, is my favorite one. Tell it every retreat. So many of you heard it before, but you obviously haven't understood it, because if you did understand it, you wouldn't need to come on a retreat ever again. The tadpole and the frog. Once there was a little tadpole, and she lived in a little pond in Jhana Grove. And she was a very smart tadpole. And she had other tadpoles there, gave her the O levels and A levels. She did very well. She went to university in the lake.
and she did chemistry in the lake. And in her chemistry classes, she learnt about water, it's H2O. She learned all the properties of water. And in that lake, there was also monks and nuns who taught her Abhidharma class on the real nature of water. And even though she wrote a PhD thesis on water, she hadn't got a clue what she was talking about. How can a tadpole know what water is? No more than a fish can understand what water is. Because born in water, lived all your life in water, you know nothing but water. It's always there. So how can you know it? But one day, little tadpole, she grew legs and arms. She became a frog. And one day, being a little frog, not really knowing what she was doing, she jumped out of the lake. And she was sitting on dry land. My goodness, this is weird. Like nothing you've ever experienced before. Imagine a tadpole going onto dry land. That is weird. But then it realized, hey, something is missing. Something which has always been here is now gone. Water. Then the frog can understand what water is once it's vanished. But it's always been there, surrounding you all the time. How can you know what it is? When it's vanished, then you have a chance to know. How can you understand what your body is? You may look in the mirror. You may go and do biology at school. Even become a doctor and cut up bodies. But do you really know what a body is? You can't. No more than a fish can know what water is. You've been living in one all your life. But one day, you become a little frog. You get into deep meditation, your body's totally gone. Wow, now I understand what it is. You go deep in meditation, and your will disappears. How can you know what will is, what choice is, when it's always surrounding you? All the time, every moment of your life. You may not use it, but it's there for you. How can you know what choice, what will is? But then you develop these jhana legs, the samadhi legs, and you jump out and go into these deep jhanas. Something is missing. This is weird. And you find out what's missing is this will. And now you know what the will truly is. It doesn't belong to you. Just all condition, cause and effect, that's all it is. But nothing to do with you. That's scary to contemplate. But that's what will happen to each one of you little tadpoles. You're already growing some legs. It's only a matter of time. And one day, hopefully on this retreat, you'll jump out and you'll be sitting in second jhana and, oh, this is weird. Uh-oh, something is missing. Choices. Will is. Now that is insight. You've seen the bus driver's seat is empty. What a relief. So, have you always been responsible and told to be responsible and say, don't do it this way, do it that way, and do it some other way, work harder and do something else, and people are always on your back trying to train your will? So great knowing there's nobody in here. You say whatever you like. You're just literally talking to a blank wall. Nobody in here. Ajahn Brahm is such a great monk. Who? I've been looking for a long time, I haven't found this Ajahn Brahm. Do you know where he is? He made such great decisions. What decisions? I never made those decisions. Nothing to do with me ordaining bhikkhunis. Please don't blame me, don't praise me. I had no choice. Not my fault. I'm totally irresponsible. Telling bad jokes? Not my fault. The reason I worked out this a long time ago, actually I gave a talk and I think Ajahn Sujata was there and he gave the title, Why Ajahn Brahm Tells Bad Jokes. It's not my fault. I have no choice, okay? The reason I tell bad jokes is because my father told bad jokes. He conditioned me, he brainwashed me. It's in my genes. I've got no choice. It's not my will. There is no will in here. I just tell them that's just the way things are. You know, one of his fate. I remember him telling this joke. He came home and said one of his best friends had a motorbike accident. And he said, now this was years ago in England, but apparently it still happens these days in some hospitals. They took him into the the hospital, had to have his leg amputated. So they took him, rushed him into the surgery. They amputated the wrong leg. You know, it happens. Even probably happens today even, let alone some time ago. And even people told me that these are nurses. They actually put a big cross on the leg. So they amputate the right one. Or they put this big sign, this one, you know, in the surgery. So the doctors don't make mistakes. But anyway, they made a mistake. They took off the good leg. And of course, as soon as they realized their mistake, it was back into surgery again. Because the other leg had to be removed. So he lost both his legs. It's a tragedy. But what happened? As soon as he was able, he got a lawyer and he sued the hospital for malpractice. But he lost his case. He lost. He didn't have a leg to stand on. I remember my father coming home and telling me that joke. So don't blame me. I've got no choice. It's good. Isn't it fun? You can just enjoy yourself and you don't feel embarrassed at all or whatever because it's totally conditioned. Nothing to do with me. So you're totally free. So, okay? So do whatever you need to do because you can't stop doing what you need to do. It's not your choice. So just have a nice time and stop trying to control your will. It doesn't belong to you. You're just a visitor, not an owner. You can totally renounce, absolutely 100%. Letting go of things you never even thought you could let go of. Letting go of even letting go. And letting go of letting go of letting go. The whole lot gets let go of. The whole lot goes. And then you have a happy time. That is insight. That is right view. You know it's right view because it makes you peaceful, free, and happy. Okay, so there you go. That gives you something not to think about. So have a nice time this morning. Interviews now. And just don't do anything, for goodness sake. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Great. Okay, so off you go and have a good day.